All right, welcome. Welcome, everyone. I'll sit, try to scooch over so I can see everyone in that corner. Thank you all for coming to this, what will be a fascinating panel discussion on how much does the planet matter. My name is Daniel Hollid. I'm a current 1+1 MBA student. My background is in analyzing agriculture projects in East Africa, and I'm fascinated to be with two amazing panelists. Just a brief introduction on what the panel is about. So we're going to be engaging on how key players in the food industry are solving the world's most pressing problem, that being climate change. Agriculture contributes to about 30% of the greenhouse gas emissions, and it requires a lot of innovative solutions that our two panelists are trying to explore and solve. And so I think you guys came to the right one, and I'm excited to begin. We're going to be focusing on the immediacy of the climate change problem, scaling within the food system, and focusing on the future. So with that, I'll let the two panelists introduce themselves.
Sure, so, can you hear me? Yeah, cool. So I'm Benjamina, I'm the co-founder and CEO of Higher Stakes. So what we do is we make meat using cell culture techniques. So rather than having to grow and raise an animal and then slaughter it, we can take just a sample of cells, so for example, a small blood sample, and grow meat from that, so that reduces the amount of environmental impact, the health impact, and obviously having to kill no animals. My background's in chemical engineering, did some work in 3D printing, fragrance and flavoring, did some marketing work with PepsiCo, and had a startup as well before.
And I'm Emily from Oddbox. So we tackle food waste primarily at farm level. And so we work directly with fresh produce suppliers, so fruit and veg suppliers. And we buy produce which either don't meet supermarket specification, so too big, too small, slightly misshapen, cosmetic imperfection, or produce which are surplus to requirements because there's a huge amount of overproduction in the system. And we currently work with over 70 different suppliers. And then we take all this produce, make boxes, so a veg box model that people can subscribe to and receive a box on a weekly or fortnightly basis. We started Oddbox 4 years ago, and we're only in London, unfortunately, but we're looking to expand nationwide this year. We've got 15,000 customers in London, and we also deliver fruit boxes for offices.
Great, thank you very much. Unfortunately, Anna Terrell from Nestle couldn't make it today, timing mishap. But I'm just going to crack on with a few questions, but we're going to hopefully lead it more for open questions to let you guys share your thoughts and interests. So with the focus of the immediacy of the climate change problem, to both of you, what gives you the excitement for your entrepreneurship opportunity to make an impactful change on sustainability within the agriculture and food industry? Benjamina, do you want to go first?
Yeah, sure. Everyone eats, so the impact that we have is so massive. And I think people are becoming more and more aware as well how much the food that we eat affects our health directly and also our environment. So I think for us, it's the mixture of actually sustainability for the environment, but also the health impact that it has on people. So in our case, trying to replace meat, so we chose to, for example, start with pork. Why? Because it has one of the biggest impact on antibiotic resistance. So that mixture, I think, is the impact that it can have on the world is just so huge that it can't not be excited by it.
And so for us, we focus primarily on food waste. So I've got kind of a few stats that some of you might know, but a third of all the food we produce worldwide never reach the consumers and is wasted. And that's got... first of all, we know that we're running out of space to grow the food that we need with growing population. So on one end, we produce a lot of food that we don't eat. On the other end, there's a lot of people who can't afford to get food. And that's, there's over a million people, over a billion people worldwide who can't afford to eat a proper meal on a daily basis. And with just a quarter of the food we waste in the UK, Europe and the US, we could feed all these people. So that means that we can solve the issue of food poverty just by solving the issue of food waste. So that's one thing. And then when you think about food poverty, it's not something which is only a problem in developing countries. It's also a huge problem in the UK. There's over 8 million people in the UK who have to skip meals regularly or have to go to food banks to get food because they can't afford, after paying all their bills, they can't afford to buy food. And there's a lot of children who have their only meal at school because of government-funded program to provide free lunch to children at school. And that means that when they're on holidays or out of school, then they don't necessarily eat on a regular basis. So that's a massive problem. We also know that food waste has a huge environmental impact. So if I was to ask you the number of liters of water that is required to grow one banana, does anybody want to have a guess? Just for one banana, liters of water.
20.
So it takes 100 liters of water to grow one banana. And that's actually the equivalent of taking a shower. So you can either decide to skip your shower in the morning, or you can decide not to waste the banana which is becoming brown on your counter. So that's kind of the kind of choice that you can make, which can have a massive impact on climate change. And people don't realize that food has such a high carbon footprint. And it's not only water, it's all the labor. Bananas are not grown here. They come from South America. So there's a lot of, obviously, soil usage, water, labor, the transportation, all of that, for all these bananas to come into the UK and then be wasted. So even before doing anything else, just looking at what you consume and making sure that everything that you have in your fridge or that you buy is consumed can make a massive difference. And that's why for us we've decided to focus on food waste, because that's something that anybody can do, and that's something which can have a massive impact. So we were mentioning that 30% of greenhouse gases come from food production, at least at in fact, out of that, 8% come from food waste. So that's massive. So for us, we feel that's a huge opportunity. So overall, of acting on our food system and acting on food waste is a massive opportunity.
I think, just if I can add, I think what's exciting is that you can really take, it's such a big problem that you have so many angles, and seeing that you can have such a big impact on, you know, from your side, but you also need really having it from all the angles. Because if, for example, with meat consumption, if it's growing, then it's going to double. We don't even have the land that we need to grow. So only 71% of land is habitable, and we're already using 40% of it for livestock. So even if we want to meet with the demand, we just simply can't. So I really think it needs to be a solution as a whole, and really thinking about all the aspects of the supply chain, and it needs to come. It needs to be an effort from all the aspects, because otherwise, we won't be able to feed the world essentially. And if we don't reduce, and you know, you talk about bananas, but obviously, you know, a chicken, and people throw as well meat, right? That they don't, and that impact is just enormous. So if we try and reduce already the impact that those components have, and on top of that work on food waste, I think we could solve those problems.
Yes, and so I was talking about the bananas, but actually meat has a much higher carbon footprint than bananas. Yeah. So just for 1 kilo of beef, it's 5,000 liters of water. And it's not because our cows drink a lot of water. It's actually because our cows eat a lot of soy, and soy requires a lot of water. Mm. And we grow a massive amount of soy in the world just for animals to eat that soy. Soy and maize are the most kind of grown grains, and it's because all these animals eat a lot of the soil. So obviously what Benjamina is doing is,
yes. If you have it in the fridge, make sure you eat it if you eat it.
Absolutely. So yeah, thanks for talking about the opportunity, and it's exciting to see you to tackle this huge challenge. I think what really interests me though is, so how do we, like the challenges of scaling it. So if we have these opportunities to address the challenges of climate change and food, what are the biggest opportunities to scale with both your organizations, and what are the biggest constraints? Emily, do you care to go first this time?
Yeah, so I think there's a massive opportunity now because people are becoming a lot more aware of the issue, and actually it's you, the younger generation, who are asking all the actors in the sector to do something about it. We've seen it with plastic waste, where the supermarkets are actually changing, reducing the access to plastic, and even kind of manufacturers are thinking about how they change from kind of plastic wrappers to kind of more plant-based or other innovative solutions. So I think as consumers, we've got a huge opportunity to make things change. So that means that for us, it's helping us scale. And the fact for us we grew 400% last year, it's because people are looking on how they can buy more sustainably. And a lot of people come to Hotbox because they know that they'll receive a box of produce with limited plastic packaging. And then they learn about the issue of food waste as they stay with us, and because we provide a lot of insight into what's happening in the produce industry. So there's the fact that there's a change in the consumer mindset, and that more and more people are asking brands to change and to provide more sustainable options is a huge opportunity.
Yeah, so in terms of opportunities, I mean, we are seeing even in the plant-based field, people like Impossible Foods or Beyond Meat actually can't keep up with the demand. Now, if you look at the market, 90% of people are meat eaters. And when you actually survey meat eaters, they prefer to go with cultivated meat rather than plant-based. So in terms of the opportunity, I mean, you have a $1 trillion market that's going to double. It's enormous. For us, actually, the biggest problem is the challenge. So it's not whether the market is there and growing the market is there, is one, keeping it, so making sure there's nothing that turns consumers against us, but also the technical challenges of scaling it.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to elaborate more on the technical challenges and the challenges of scaling now?
Yeah, so, I mean, we leverage our technologies from the biotech field. Now, in the biotech field, what do? They do things at tiny scale and really, really high cost. So you'll have a piece of skin like this big that will cost you $2,000. We're trying to make pieces of meat, you know, a kilogram of meat, right, for £2. So essentially reversing that means that we have a lot of technical challenges. So the first one is actually having a cell line that is constantly the same, that is reliable. So really being able to get the same results from that cell line over and over again. So maybe I'll elaborate a little bit more about how it works, but essentially you take a sample of cells from the animal. So this could be, you know, a blood sample or a small skin patch. In our case, we're working with induced pluripotent stem cells, which essentially in nature you have embryonic stem cells and adult stem cells. And this is a way of taking any cell from the animal body and bringing it back to the embryonic state, meaning that you can expand them a lot more, but you can also make any type of tissue. So from a blood sample, you can make muscle, fat, liver, connective tissue, blood, anything you need. So this is an innovation that won the Nobel Prize back in 2012. And so once you have those cells, you grow them in something called the media, which is same way as you eat every day. The cells eat every day, but you can't obviously just put like a bunch of vegetables with the cells, they would die. So you're trying to essentially have a liquid that mimics the blood and already is kind of pre-digested to feed the cells and get them to grow and then differentiate, so become the muscle and the fat and so on. So that process at the moment is too expensive and is quite unreliable. So if you know, you can use even the same the same cell line and do that experiment in Italy rather than the UK, and you'll have a completely different result. Or sometimes, I mean, even, you know, just tiny, tiny changes could change the whole process. So it's really about that consistency, that scalability of the cells as well, making sure they can expand as much as we need them to expand, but also obviously the cost, because now, so the media, some of the components in the media, you're talking about tens of millions per gram. So obviously this is not something that at least I can afford.
Yeah, so I think kind of price is still one of the main challenge, or kind of cost is still one of the main challenge in sustainability, because so it's changing, but sustainability is still seen as being a more expensive choice. It's not necessarily always the case, because you can buy better and buy less, and there's, for example, in fashion, you can thrift, you can buy secondhand, and that's not necessarily more expensive. For us, the reason why we focused on working directly with suppliers and buying produce that they're not able to sell is because these produce are still perfectly good quality, but because there's less of a market for them, or in fact, in most cases, they just leave them in the field or send that for animal feed when it's still perfectly good, we're able to buy the produce for cheaper. And therefore, we're able to sell our boxes for almost the same price as what it would be buying the same fruit and veg in a supermarket. So we're trying to change, and with scale, it helps that with scale, we can make sustainability affordable and not something that has a premium attached to it. So it's quite important that sustainability becomes kind of the easy choice.
But if I can add, correct me if I'm wrong, but actually probably wasting the food, your cost is costing you more, right? If you bought some vegetables for £10, then you can't use them, then, I mean, a huge amount of money is wasted by just buying the food and not using it. So it's probably more expensive as a way of living.
Great, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Unfortunately, we don't have Anna here, so we don't get to see how large multinational companies interact with entrepreneurs, but at the smaller scale. But could you maybe elaborate on how you are interacting with large multinational companies, and will that be addressing a lot of the problems of cost and behavioral change that both of you brought up?
Yeah, absolutely. Because we're creating a completely new supply chain, we won't be able to create all the aspects of it. If we have to think about, okay, now, you know, we have to manufacture this, we have to have all the different components of the media coming in, the bioreactors, are actually producing those bioreactors, creating them, everything around distribution, packaging, all of that. All of this has to actually leverage some existing solutions, but also some new solutions. Even, for example, a small idea, if any of you want to start it, but our meat won't have the same microbiome as conventional meat, so actually possibly adding that at the end of the process, making sure we can get all the right nutrients is a whole startup possibly by itself, or maybe it's something that the bigger corporates can do. So we are seeing some people. What's quite interesting is that we're seeing people from different fields. So you're seeing people from the biotech field that are actually starting to look at food. Whereas before, I remember 2 years ago when I started, you would contact contract manufacturers or a large organization in the biotech field, and they think you're crazy to even why would you talk about food when I can sell an organ, for much higher prices, or even organ on a chip, right? The tiny things. But now they're actually seeing it is as big of a problem, and it is a huge market opportunity. So they're starting to actually, people like Thermo Fisher are starting to think, well, I'm not just going to produce my, the media, the liquid for the cells, not just going to do it for the biotech field, but actually, can I make it cheaper and help those companies evolve and scale, and I will be their go-to person as they scale. And similarly, people like Merck. And then you're seeing as well the food side, where a lot of meat processors, they don't really care what is the meat that's coming, right? If it's vegetables, if it's conventional meat, or if it's cultivated meat, they take it and make a sausage out of it and distribute it. So for people like that, it's quite exciting. And if the market is bigger and growing for this, it's definitely an opportunity. So there's a lot of opportunities to collaborate, but also if we really want to reach our goals to take, you know, to take over at least really significant percent of the meat market in the coming years, we won't be able to scale alone. Every factory will cost us hundreds of million. No startup will be able to do it alone. It will require a lot of collaboration with larger companies, and that can take a lot of different forms.
Have you found a similar experience?
Yeah, so for us it's slightly different because so we work with quite big companies in the produce industry, so people who actually grow or import fresh fruit and veg. But we don't work directly with supermarkets. But the way we see our proposition, because we work with the same people who supply the supermarket, we feel that we're complementary to what they do. So they are very much demand-driven. They need to give consumers the fruit and veg that they want to see on the shelf. For us, we're supply-driven. People don't choose what goes in our boxes. So we're able to take the things that they're not able to sell. So we feel in terms of future partnership with supermarkets that that could be something that us working closer and really kind of taking all of the produce that their suppliers are not able to sell, but right now that's not been too much of a focus. And they've got, so in terms of why there's lots of startups who are kind of addressing issues that big business are not able to address is because when you're a big organization, then things are slower and you've got processes in place. For example, there's a lot of waste which happens because of the way the supply chain works in the industry. So I'll give you kind of a couple of examples. When you go to a supermarket, you'll find a bag of apples. All the apples will look the same and be the same size because it's a lot easier to put 5 apples of 200 grams in a 1 kilo bag than putting a lot of different size apples. So they've kind of standardized some of their processes to make it easier because of the way they package. Similarly, the machine which wraps the cucumbers only take straight cucumbers. So all the curly ones actually get discarded because they can't fit into the machine. And similarly, in terms of transportation, when everything is kind of the same size, it's more efficient. So it's going to take them a lot of time and new machinery and new supply chain innovations to be able to really kind of have solutions in place. Whilst for us, because we are smaller, we are more flexible, we put the produce without packaging in the boxes, it actually doesn't matter too much what the size and shape of the produce.
Can I ask you a question, actually? So how do you see it when, so obviously those organizations managed to get to that scale because they were that efficient. How do you think you'll manage to get to that scale without having that efficiency, right? It was a decision, obviously, that they made to be that efficient with those sizes. How will you go around that and without, you know, with different sizes and so on?
So for us, we're able, in terms of kind of packing efficiencies, we're able to be quite efficient, and there's some automation that we can put in place. There's still going to be a lot of manual labor involved, but in terms of our model, we're bringing innovation in other places. Okay. For example, in terms of the delivery, so all the big retailers are kind of going towards fast delivery. So you order, then you can receive your order within 1 hour. For us, we're at the complete opposite. You actually can't choose which day we deliver to you. We deliver overnight and leave the box on your doorstep. So it's nice because you get it when you wake up in the morning. But we only deliver one day a week to each area so that we can optimize our deliveries and make sure that even though it's delivered and there's carbon footprint impact, it's minimized because we'll have three, four customers in the same street, and then they get their deliveries on the same days at the same time. So there's kind of ways of innovating which are slightly different and which kind of, so for us, we go against that fast one-hour delivery.
Cool, so interesting, different approaches to how you're addressing larger companies. And the last question I had, kind of focusing on the and beyond and the future, so what is your primary worry facing your company and sustainability, and how are you going to try to address that issue in the future, short term and long term? Would you like to go first?
Sure. I mean, the primary worry, I think the tech, it's the mixture of things. So actually balancing out the tech and regulations and, you know, time and capital and kind of balancing it all out, because if you have all the time in the world and all the capital in the world, no problem, I'm pretty sure we'll get the tech done. But it's really doing it within the time frame that we want. And also regulation is one of the biggest concerns. So at the moment, in Europe, we'd go through the novel food regulations. In the US, it's USDA and FDA that jointly regulate us, but there's no details out there. So there's estimates of time, there's estimates of money, there's estimates of what we would have to do. But again, there are some rules that could change everything. And obviously, there's a big threat to us is the meat lobby that's very strong around the world. Luckily, the big meat producers, so people like Tyson and Cargill, are invested in the space and want to be part of it rather than against it. But again, this is something that they're doing now. When it becomes a real threat, there's nothing saying that they won't put all their resources to go against us.
So for us, obviously, there are some challenges. I don't think we have a big worry. We've got lots of hope, and we're seeing a lot of change. So for us, in terms of kind of next challenge, it's we're only in London, so it's expanding outside of London. But really, through our model, because we're a direct-to-consumer model, for us, it's really about helping people on their sustainability journey, educating about what's happening in the produce industry, why this standard exists. And also, we want to make sure that people... So we address food waste at farm level, but we also address food waste in people's home, because 50% of the waste actually happens in our own homes. So it's not so much... at retail level, there's a lot at farm level, a lot at home, and very little at the retail level. So it's really kind of making sure that we don't push produce which would be wasted on the farm into people's home, and that we help people kind of cook with the produce which comes in the boxes, and provide tips, recipes, and education about how to become more sustainable.
Thank you. So just kind of a synthesis of what we've talked about so far, there's a lot of opportunities in addressing the issues of climate change and agriculture, which you two are both addressing. However, there's cost and behavioral issues. But with awareness and collaboration in the food system, such as consumers, tech, producers, entrepreneurs, regulation, policymakers, and that's how we're going to try to keep on moving forward with this. With that, I'll open it up for discussion. We have about 25 minutes, so I'm excited that we can get going on some juicy questions. We'll take two at a time. So, please.
Hi, so I'm just asking specifically about the cultivated meat question. So I understand that in the long term, this is probably going to be a significant competitor to conventional meats, but what I was wondering is that how does this compare to other meat alternatives, specifically plant-based? So, like, in your opinion, how is cultivated meat going to fare against Beyond Meat, for example, or Impossible Burgers? Thank you.
Should I answer?
I will just go on it. Yeah, that works.
Yeah. So, I mean, the first thing is that it's not going to be one or the other. There will be place for both. I think where it differs is that it is actually meat, and particularly when we start moving towards the more complex products. So when you start talking about chicken breast or steaks or things like that, we have a much better chance at having exactly the same because we are actually working with the same components. So from what I've tasted from the plant-based side, yes, it's getting better. Yes, it's good. It can replace some aspects. But it's still not an exact, you know, an exact change for conventional meat, whereas we will get to the stage where you will have two products that are exactly the same nutritional profile, exactly the same texture, taste, look, and the only difference will really be the way we got there and therefore the impact we have on the environment, on people's health, and on animal. I think also the other part is that, you know, it will be more of a process. So I think over time we could actually become cheaper than plant-based because you take the cells in the beginning, but actually the products, some of the products that we're using can be done synthetically, and therefore the price could get a lot, you know, could get a lot cheaper than plant-based. This is talking, you know, 30, 40 years from now, obviously. At the beginning, we'll start at a premium, and we, you know, we will be more expensive than plant-based. But I think over time, I could see it become cheaper than plant-based, and I think it's addressing a different market. So the real meat eaters, I think, will prefer cultivated meat. And when you look at, for example, a burger or a sausage, it's easy to say, well, yeah, that sausage plant-based, and the sausage with meat that also has a lot of other components in it is nutritionally exactly the same. When you start comparing chicken breast to, you know, some of the plant-based alternatives, it isn't exactly the same. So that's the main difference. But I believe that it will be not one or the other, but really a solution with both.
Hi. Both projects are great. Thank you for sharing. This is for Benjamina. This is, again, for the lab-grown meat. I grew up in a smallholder cattle farmer in Costa Rica, and my vision or my thinking with lab-grown meat is, for example, Cargill is not the one that produces the meat. It actually supplies it from smallholder farmers, right? So 30 years from now, like, what's your vision of how these farmers are going to transition into what? You know, like, you know, what are they going to do? What is my dad going to do with its farm? What is it going to transition to? Yeah.
Yeah. So I think small farmers will actually not really be the ones replaced. I think for a while, if not forever, you will always have kind of small farmers still, you know, selling meat, and it will be something that people eat. What we're really trying to replace is the factory farming and those mass amounts of meats that are made. Yes, that's also farmers. I think there are different possibilities. There is moving towards more plants, right? So as the plant-based sector is growing, they could adapt to that. And also, possibly, you know, price of meat right now is artificially low. And they might be able to have a more niche, essentially become more of a niche, and not have, you know, they don't want to grow those quantities. They have to do it because the price is, you know, is so low and competition is so high. But it potentially just having more, everyone, you know, all those farmers moving to a more sustainable and humane way of farming rather than the mass, you know, the mass production that is today. But also you're seeing, you know, different farmers staying within the farming industry but switching the way they're working. But, you know, it's difficult. It's a difficult question, which we're exploring and a lot of people are thinking about. But I think for the time being, for the next, you know, 10, 20 years, small farmers will definitely have their place. And even, you know, big farmers, like, it's going to be an exponential change, but not a step change, right? It's not going to be one day to another, everyone will wake up, and there will be no more meat, right? It will take time for the industry to grow, and that time will allow for changes to happen and people to adapt.
And I think there's a lot of focus on regenerative farming. Mm. So people are now thinking about how has it, the soil been used? So it might be more in terms of grains and fruit and veg, but I think even in terms of the meat is what kind of the animals been fed, and also kind of so obviously we know that animals produce a lot of methane, which is one of the most harmful greenhouse gas, but that's only when when there's too many of them in one place. So I think there's ways of having a farming kind of industry which is good for the environment, and that's where kind of that regenerative farming, where we're moving towards, where actually farming doesn't have a negative impact on the environment.
And that's the thing, I think that necessarily won't be able to feed the whole world, right? So we need, as I said in the beginning, it really needs to be a mixture of solutions, working all towards that goal, rather than one solution that will take over, because even if you did cultivate, everyone only ate cultivated meat, I'm sure that would have some impacts that we can predict, right? So I think more and more people are realizing it can be one solution, but it really is taking it from all aspects and realizing that this is a problem that everyone needs to address.
Hi, this is a question for Emily. Your supply is based on out-of-spec products and surplus, which I believe the surplus, it comes up peaks in the season, is not consistent. As supermarkets lower the standards, you've seen some supermarkets taking on the ugly fruit, so they are being less strict on the specs. As you scale up, my question is, do you think there will come a point where you could potentially start competing with supermarkets for the same fruit?
So supermarkets actually already sell some of the out of specs. So, and they've always done that. So there's always been kind of cheaper kind of version of things that now they've rebranded as kind of a wonky ranch, they've kind of gone onto the trend of wonky, and so kind of their cheapest options are now the wonky range. So they've always taken some element, some amount of the lower class or the misshapen, and you can find kind of misshapen strawberries. Asda did kind of wonky boxes a few years ago. It's a lot of PR, and the problem that they have is that if people buy more of this range, because they want to make sure that that's available all the time, then they have to supplement with kind of the perfect quality product. So for them, it's a bit of eating into their margins, so they don't really want to do that. The problem is that they are very much demand-driven, so they need to make sure that everything is available all the time on the shelf. So we're addressing more and more the issue of surplus, because what goes in our boxes is what's surplus at specific times of the year. And so, for example, right now, we don't have any berries in our boxes because it's not the season. Unfortunately, we have a lot of potatoes, carrots, root veg, kale, and things which are in surplus. And so that variety, there's a lot more seasonality in our boxes than what you would find in the supermarket. As we scale very long term, there might be an issue in terms of supply, but then there's so much surplus production and produce wasted right now that it's not going to happen for quite a long time. So we wouldn't mind kind of if at some point we run out of business because there are actually no problem to be addressed. But we think it's quite a long while until that happens.
Hi. I have a question about scale. You've both mentioned scaling, and I think that for most companies that are starting out, that is a big thing that they need to think about. But for you both, I'd like you to maybe describe what you mean in terms of scaling your specific businesses. Is it a case of scaling to new markets? Is it just kind of growing your market share in the markets that you currently service? So looking at new product lines, I'd like to interrogate that a bit further. Thanks.
Yeah. So for us, I mean, the first challenge is actually even doing a scale where we can sustain selling to one restaurant, right? Right now we are, you know, talking lab scale. So first step would be to actually be able to even scale it to a scale where we can make any profit. Well, not even profit, any revenue. And then obviously, but we want to create already now processes that don't, you know, it serves us nothing if we can reach 1,000 kilograms, but then can't ever go to 1,000,000 kilograms, right? That's when we actually have an impact. So it's really creating processes that we can see evolves into the billions and billions of kilograms that are necessary. But yes, yeah, so the first step, it's even getting to the scale where we can commercialize it, essentially.
So for us, in terms of, so what we mean by scaling, so right now, we're only in London, so our next challenge in terms of scaling, it's expanding outside of London, because we know that there's people, so we've got a waiting list of people who want to sign up to Hotbox, but don't live in London, so that's kind of the next challenge. We want to concentrate on fruit and veg for now, however, don't mean that we can't explore other types of food. There's a lot of waste which happens because of things which are mislabeled or change in branding, best before date. So there's waste in all food categories that potentially we could address, but it requires similarly kind of education about best before date, kind of what can be eaten for how long, and kind of that working, and that would mean working with potentially food manufacturers to take produce that they're not able to sell because of these issues.
Hi, my name is Dmytro. I'm finance, energy, and sustainability background. And I have a question to you both, and I have two questions. So first question to Benjamina. We talk how much water we use to grow beef. What is the energy conversion factor for artificial meat compared to organic meat?
Water?
Excuse me?
Energy or water?
Like both, energy, water. How can you compare it to organic growth? And the second question is about in your market ecosystems, where do you see the biggest gap? Where do you see the opportunity for other players to step in to help you to develop your business?
So the first question, so there's been life cycle assessments made showing about, compared to conventional beef, about 90% reduction in water land usage was around 99%. CO2 emissions was somewhere between 80 to 95%. And energy was around 45%, but to be honest, the energy one, I think, is probably not accurate. But again, it's where do we actually take that energy from, right? And these are life cycle assessments that were made on pharmaceutical kind of standard processes. Each company will have to look at their exact processes and do their own life cycle assessments. So there's now more precise life cycle assessments that are being made, taking some actual company data. But I think each company will at some point have to make their own life cycle assessment once, and that point is really when the process is defined. So before, for example, applying for the novel food regulation, you already have a process that's defined that's not going to massively change. And when you're able to know really what your supply chain will look like, right? Where are you taking what from? What type of bioreactor you have? What energy they use? So really being able to get to that detail. Us personally, we're not there yet, but it's something that's definitely important for us to do. But I think you also, you know, as Emily mentioned, with bigger businesses, they already have their factories, they already have their thing. It's much harder to change. Whereas when you're starting something from scratch, it's quite easy, you know, to say, you know, for example, actually, when you talk about farmers, so Sanofi has a biopharmaceutical plant in India, and all their energy is coming from actual waste from farmers that they then transfer to energy, so biofuels, right? So making sure that we use the right solution and think about our system as a whole rather than just the, you know, smaller parts of the process.
The second question was...
For both.
Yeah,
Can you repeat your second question?
Yeah, that would be great. Sorry.
Yeah, in your industries, your ecosystem, there is definitely gaps. What are these gaps are, and like which players do you want to see in the system to help your businesses to grow?
So there's gaps kind of at so for us in terms of if I talk specifically about the fresh produce, there's gaps at kind of all levels of the supply chain. So at farm level, there's very little reporting of how much waste or surplus is actually produced because, first of all, no growers want to overproduce. They all want to have accurate forecasting and be able to sell all the things they grow. And because these produce don't have a value, then anything that they might leave in the field or send to animal feed, they don't necessarily track because they can't sell it. So there's no price paid for what stays in the field. So it's called fertilizer, kind of compost, or it's to help kind of keep the soil healthy, but they don't track how much is left. When in fact all of that is actually wasted. If they send it to animal feed, they don't track because they don't get any revenue from that. So there's opportunities at the start of the chain to really use data to kind of understand a lot more how much is tracked. And there's been a few academic research done, but the numbers very much vary between 10 to 50% of a crop might be wasted. So there's a huge kind of bracket from 10 to 50%. So there's opportunities in terms of so electric vehicles or the delivery, there's opportunities there. Right now we deliver, so we use a third party company to deliver our boxes and they deliver with diesel vans because of the electric vans don't have a range which is big enough for our requirements. And also in terms of size, they are too small. So it's a big challenge that nobody in the industry really uses electric vehicles. So there's opportunities there. So at every kind of element of the supply chain, there's a lot of opportunities. Similarly, in terms of packaging, there's lots of opportunities to kind of think about alternative packaging.
Yeah, I mean, I could spend another hour talking about the opportunities. To keep it short and leave other questions, I recommend if you want to see the opportunities, so the Good Food Institute has published a white paper highlighting some of the opportunities in the space and areas where people are not working enough on it or where there's more. It still hasn't been solved. So that's one, and the other is a company called Wild Type that are making salmon. They also have a Medium post looking at the whole supply chain and what are the areas that people are working a lot on and which ones people are working less on, which could help. So I would recommend, Good Food Institute, so GFI, has a white paper on cultivated meat spaces, and the other is Wild Type, their Medium.
We have time for two more questions. Saskia has one.
Thank you very much for your talk. I had a question more about the policy side of things. I think you both have very market-driven solutions, which is fantastic. And I was wondering if you could give examples of policies that would really accelerate the process, so something you'd like to see happen, or maybe something that has already happened in some countries that you think is inspiring and could be replicated.
So maybe I can start. So in terms of kind of specifically on food waste, so there's a lot of there's a lot of charities who will work with retailers and collect food waste. Now there's no policy around that; it's not mandatory. Whilst in France, it's mandatory for retailers, so supermarkets, to donate any surplus food they have. They can't throw anything in the bin. So that's something quite easy that governments could quite easily put in place. So retailers already do that, but then having kind of a strict regulation that nothing can go to the bin would be quite powerful. So that's one example where some countries are more advanced. In terms of organic, the UK is very is lagging behind in terms of organic, and there's very little. So nobody really knows whether organic is better or not. And there's been little done in terms of education for consumers to really choose. And similarly, in terms of recycling, so I don't know how it is in Oxford, but in London, depending on the borough, they collect, some boroughs will collect food waste, some don't. People have no clue about what can be recycled, so all the logos of recycling are still very confusing, and I think we all kind of mix and match what we put in a recycling bin versus the normal bin. So there's a lot which can be done there as well.
Yeah, for us, I mean, the first thing is actually publishing regulations and really, you know, detailed guidelines so that we would have as good of an understanding of how we'll go through regulation as someone launching a new drug. Obviously, there is some things that could help us. So things like, you know, removing subsidies on meat, or even more strictly actually taxing carbon emissions and meat, that would help us. Things like allowing for genetic engineering globally would help us. There are some countries that are more advanced, others not. When it comes to meat, it's actually often, I mean, even the US, one animal ever went through it. It's a salmon, and it took 20 years. So we're not growing a full animal, so it might be easier, but again, it's still a risk, and obviously, we'll still have the consumer problem around that, so we decided not to go with genetic engineering. But, you know, policies that will explain. So even in the U.S., they changed the kind of GMO mark to make it more friendly and make it less scary. Just simple things like that actually help the industry.
Time for one more quick question.
I had a quick question just about your perception and thoughts on, like, the word waste when it's used either in your businesses or when you're discussing these things, because I think when we hear a lot about the wastage that's occurring, like in the example of the banana, right, like, are we concerned about the banana going bad or being thrown out because of, like, the climate carbon impact, or is it more of, like, a larger, I don't know, a philosophical concern about wastage in, like, privileged countries versus scarcity in others? So I'd love to get your thoughts and opinions on that.
Can you repeat the start of the question?
Sure, like your perception of the word and usage of the word waste.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's why kind of for us we use more surplus than waste, because it's something isn't wasted until it actually kind of ends up in landfill. So it stays as surplus, and there's that negative connotation to the word waste. So more and more we talk about surplus and resource utilization more than waste. So the terms that people use really have a huge impact, and so yes, I would kind of encourage everyone to talk about surplus more than waste.
Do you have any thoughts on waste?
Yeah.
No, I mean, I think I agree it's surplus and labeling. I mean, for us, it's not the word waste, but even whether we call it lab-grown meat, cell-based meat. I mean, lab-grown meat doesn't make sense for us just because, I mean, everything at some point was in the lab. Like all your biscuits and cereals, where do you, you know, where did they start? Often, you know, in the lab, and then it became a manufacturing process, like ours would be, right? Beer, again, is done in breweries and bioreactors, similar to what we will be. So I think the term lab-grown meat is out, but what do we actually call it? Are we allowed to call it meat? What are the advantages and disadvantages of doing so is definitely a debate that we have.
So, in conclusion, clearly the planet matters a lot, and to tackle the issues with climate change, we have to solve the agriculture issue, and as we discussed, it requires systemic change and understanding the integration of all these changes. Let's give a round of applause for panelists, and thank you for coming. Thank you.